the little book of Ruth, just four chapters, but a very bright spot in a dark time in Israel's history. The book of Ruth is set in the time period of the judges. The book opens up in the first verse telling us that these events took place during the time that the judges ruled. And we've studied the book of Judges together. No, that was a period in Israel's history that was characterized by apostasy, unfaithfulness to God, a reoccurring pattern of turning their back on God, on His blessings, on His goodness to them, and thus necessitating the chastening of the Lord in discipline. During that time of real spiritual darkness and decadence in the land, there were people who stood firm and true. There were godly people, but godliness did not characterize the people of God in those days. And in chapter 1, we looked at some of those key people, in particular two, Naomi and her daughter-in-law Ruth. The setting for this story was a man took his family and left Bethlehem during a famine and moved to the land of Moab. In the land of Moab, that man died. His two sons married Moabite women, and then those two sons died. There were no children born in those marriages. And that left three widows, Naomi, then her two daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah. And this situation is one that perhaps a little more difficult for us to grasp today. Certainly widowhood today can bring extra pressures and trials. Sometimes a person can be very well destitute. But in biblical times, it was even a more severe situation. Because without a husband and family, there was no one to care for those widows. And they were left to fend for themselves, to try to eke out a living by gleaning in the fields, as we'll note in a moment. In this kind of environment, the woman Naomi decides to return to her homeland and her hometown of Bethlehem. And she encourages her daughters to return to their homes in Moab. One daughter-in-law does. The other, Ruth, chooses to go back to Bethlehem with her. And that was the substance of the first chapter. The reoccurring emphasis of the first chapter, it was the hand of the Lord bringing this adversity and difficulty into the life of Naomi. I have an aunt, and we call her Naoma, but the biblical character we know as Naomi. She never failed or wavered, from what we can tell, in her faith in God. She never became bitter. In fact, with all of this adversity and pain and bitterness that God brought into her life, her commitment and her faith and her testimony is strong enough that her daughter-in-law, Ruth, makes an irreversible commitment herself to Naomi's God and Naomi's people and returns to Bethlehem with her. And we can appreciate the stability of Naomi, that she would acknowledge, for example, in chapter 1, verse 13, the end of the verse, "The hand of the Lord has gone against me." Then over in verse 21, Naomi said, "Call me not Naomi," which means pleasant or sweet, "but Mara," which means bitter. And that does not mean she had become bitter towards God, but that God had brought bitterness into her life, unpleasantness, harshness. And she acknowledges it as the hand of the Lord. "The Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me." The Almighty, Shaddai, the all-powerful, all-sovereign God, the God who could have done otherwise in my life if He had chosen, has dealt bitterly with me. Verse 21, "The Lord has witnessed against me. The Almighty has afflicted me." Again, that reoccurring emphasis that the sovereign God has done this. Shaddai, the all-powerful one. And in reality, what is our responsibility? To submit to our God. To believe that He is doing what is right and best, as painful And as difficult as this might be, keep in mind that the difficulties and trials of this woman are spread over a period of years. She suffered the pain of the loss of her husband and her two sons. She knows the pain of being totally destitute, without hope in the world in many ways. Yet she sees the hand of God in it all, and she submits to that. Before we look into chapter 2, turn over to the New Testament, to 2 Corinthians 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. The Apostle Paul writes of his experience. And in many ways, the Apostle Paul could say, "The Lord has dealt bitterly with me." Because as we read his testimony, much of his life was characterized by hardship and difficulty. We don't know much about his immediate family, but we know when it came to the end of his life, he has to testify that everyone has abandoned me. And I had to face my trial without the friends that had left me. Well, in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 8, "We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not despairing, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus." He was constantly being afflicted, constantly suffering. He said, "That hasn't destroyed me." Down in verse 16, "Therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory." That perspective that my confidence is in God. But if He's the all-powerful, all-sovereign God, why would He bring this into my life? Paul was willing to accept it, as was Naomi, as what God had determined as right and best for the accomplishing of His purposes in their lives at this time. And that's all they would know, and all they could know. Over in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul talks about the messenger of Satan that came to buffet him. And it evidently caused him great pain, great suffering, great difficulty, because he prayed three times that the Lord would give him deliverance. And the response of the Lord in verse 9 was, "My grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness." How often we pray for the power of God in our lives. When adversity and difficulty and trial and weakness come, we complain and ask, "What is God doing?" He's giving perhaps the power that we so earnestly ask for. Power is perfected in weakness. Paul's response, "Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses, that the power of Christ may dwell in me." Is there anything that you would exchange the power of Christ in your life for? Is there anything more important than having the power of Christ work in and through you? Paul says, "I'm willing to suffer anything that the power of Christ might rest and dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content," not just putting up with something, "I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Why? When I am weak, the power of Christ works in and through me. What do we know about Naomi if it hadn't been for the difficulties and trials that she had to go through? But for the last several millenniums, would the people of God found encouragement and strength from studying the life of Naomi if it hadn't been characterized by trial and hardship? And when you look at it, what a small price to pay for being such a mighty instrument in the hand of God. How many lives have been touched by the testimony of Naomi and Ruth over the centuries of time? Now keep in mind, we know this looking back. As they are plodding on day after day, month after month, year after year, with these unbearable burdens, they didn't have the comfort of knowing, well, God is going to use this to impact multitudes of lives. It's His power at work in a great way. Naomi was willing to accept His power is at work. He's brought the adversity. But she did not have the joy of seeing the results of that in the same way that we do as we study it today. That's true of the adversities of your life and of my life. The only thing I can do is walk by it with God, step by step, in faith, confident He's doing the right thing. God, use this adversity that You have brought into my life to magnify Yourself. And I have to be satisfied to leave it there. Perhaps sometime He'll privilege me to see why. Perhaps He will not in this life. But either way, I know that the God who is Shaddai, the all-powerful, has it all under control. Come back to the book of Ruth. Chapter 1 ended with Ruth and Naomi returning into Bethlehem, and it's at the barley harvest time. Now, chapter 2 is going to give us a little different dimension. Chapter 1 stressed the fact that God is sovereign, that God is all-powerful, even in the difficulties and tragedies of our life. But now as we come into chapter 2, we're going to see God's sovereignty, God's power at work in protecting and providing for His children, even in their difficulties. By the time we're done chapter 2, the adversity and the trials and the difficulties will still be there. Perhaps softened a bit, but it's still two widow women attempting to provide food for the table, and that's all that they're able to do at this point. The chapter opens up by introducing us to the third main character in this book, Naomi, Ruth, and now the man Boaz. Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Whose name was Boaz. Now, some very important information here, and he's introduced to us, and then we'll leave him go for a time. But the point is to prepare us and set the stage for what is going to take place. And it's almost that a person is relating the account or the story here, and they want us to know ahead of time how important this man is so we can appreciate as he comes into the picture the marvelous way that God is working and directing. So it's almost like the person telling this story says, now, keep in mind, Boaz is a relative of Elimelech. He is a mighty man. He's a man of stature and importance. And he is, keep in mind, a relative of Elimelech. Now, let me tell you what transpired. Because it's very important here. Boaz is not a relative of Naomi, but a relative of Elimelech. Because Boaz is going to be the kinsman redeemer for Ruth and Naomi ultimately. But he could not have done that if he was the relative of Naomi. He had to be the relative of Elimelech to function as the kinsman redeemer. So here we're introduced to a man who will become the focal point of what is going to take place in the rest of the book of Ruth. What is related in chapter 2 has to do with the provision that God had made in Israel for the poor. Their privilege to go and glean in the fields. During the harvest time, a man could not reap his field right out to the very edge. He had to leave the borders or the edges. And once he had gone through the field, and you know, they go through with the sickle and cut the grain and carry it and bundle as they went, they couldn't go back and pick up the stalks of grain that had fallen off as they went through the field. The borders or edges of the field and the stalks of grain that were dropped were to be left for the poor in Israel. That's why they weren't allowed to go all the way to the edge of their field, or they weren't allowed to go over their field a second time. This was God's provision for the poor. Then the poor were allowed to come in after the harvest and go through the field and gather up any stalks of grain that had fallen down. And there would be, naturally, a number of these, since you're doing it by hand, you're carrying it by hand, and also the edges of the field. So that's the provision in Israel for the poor. You want to study that a little bit. Leviticus 19:9, Leviticus 23:22, Deuteronomy 24:19 to 21 talk about this provision. Now that's the basis for what is going to take place in this chapter. Verse 2. Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." You know the characteristic in the book of Ruth is she is repeatedly identified as the Moabitess. Would be enough to say Ruth, but in verse 2 it's Ruth the Moabitess. Down in verse 6, it will be the young Moabite woman. Down in verse 21, Ruth the Moabitess. In chapter 1, verse 22, Ruth the Moabitess. This constant reminder of the greatness of God's grace. Because we're not even dealing here with an Israelite woman. We're dealing with the foreigner, the outsider. And yet God, in a marvelous way, because of her commitment and faith in the God of Israel and identifying with His people, is providing and caring for her. What Ruth does, and she's familiar with the provision, perhaps Naomi had told her. They would have had to have some conversations. What are we going to do for food? And Naomi could have shared with her, "Well, this is what God says we can do in the land of Israel." And Ruth takes the initiative here. But she asks for Naomi's permission. This may indicate that Naomi is perhaps a little too old to be out gleaning in the field herself. So Ruth is going to go. Now keep in mind, we're going to talk about here is hard work. Back-breaking work, so to speak. Bent over, walking through the field, trying to gather up these, and doing it all day long in the heat of the sun, as will come out in the story. So don't get the idea that now they're back in Israel and they can go and glean in this field and that's going to be an easy task. This is difficult, hard, back-breaking work, as we would talk about it. Naomi gives Ruth permission. Go. What's the choice? We can't sit here and starve. So Ruth asks, "Let me go and glean among the ears after one in whose sight I may find favor." She's going to seek permission to go into a field. And this may have been the customary thing, to ask the servant in charge of the harvest, "May I glean after your harvesters?" Perhaps they limited, allowed certain ones, certain numbers into their field. Verse 3, "So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz." Now you talk about luck. Of all the fields in the area, she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz. It says happened to come to the portion of the field. One field, but it's Boaz's portion. In those days, they didn't have fences. They didn't use fences or clearly marked lines. If you'd look out, it would look like one large field. But they had marking stones that those who owned the land knew very clearly where their land was. But if you just went and looked at the field, it would look like one big field, and you could wander from one person's field to another and not even realize it. But the owners of the field knew from the boundary stones. Remember, the Old Testament is very clear in forbidding any tampering with the boundary stones, which clearly marked the parts of land. Now, you connect verse 3 with verse 1. So while humanly speaking, it looked like she just happened to wander into Boaz's field. We've already been told in verse 1, this just isn't a happening. This just isn't chance. This is the Boaz that is the relative of Elimelech, who is a very significant person in Israel. So as you read, she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz. We've already been prepared for this. That the providential hand of God is at work in guiding her, even as she looks for the proper field. Boaz came from Bethlehem to the field. Now again, all these details, we're talking about, is God concerned with the details? Well, Ruth had to be in the right field at the right time. Boaz had to come out to visit his field at the right time. All these things come together, and you see the sovereignty of God in the little details. That would seem at first glance, does it really matter whether Ruth gleans in this field or this field as long as she can get enough to eat? It makes a terrific, tremendous difference. In fact, it's going to make a difference all the way down to the Messiah, because she's going to be in the line of the Messiah. Tremendously important. Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, "May the Lord be with you." They said to him, "May the Lord bless you." And you get something of the character of Boaz. Oh, even with his workers and his servants, his discussion is in the context of the blessings of God, Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel. Then Boaz has a discussion in verse 5, 6, and 7 with the servant who's in charge of the reapers. So he's overseeing the harvest for Boaz. And Boaz asks about the new young woman. So it was probably a normal pattern that you got used to those who gleaned in your field. You naturally knew your servants, but you would also get to recognize the poor that regularly frequented the harvest in your fields. But here is a new woman that he recognizes, and he asks, "Whose woman is this?" They well have thought that she was married, but her and her husband were very poor, and she is out trying to get food for the table. The servant tells him, "This is the young Moabite woman," in verse 6. "The one who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab." You see what has happened here? The faith and the commitment of Ruth has made the rounds. People are talking about that kind of commitment. Willingness to abandon her people and identify with Naomi and her God and her people. This is the Moabites that we've heard about. "And she asked me, 'Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves.'" So she had sought his permission. One thing you appreciate in recognizing the character of Ruth, that she evidences a real humility in her life. She's a godly woman. And there's no coming here spouting off, "You know, the law says I have the right to glean in your field." That's true, but there is the coming of, "Can I have that privilege to glean in your field?" "She came and has remained from the morning until now, has been sitting in the house for a little while." So she came early in the morning, and she has been gleaning all day and took a little rest, sat in the house. They would build a temporary house, the few poles up with the thatch over it, so that the workers could get in out of the beating sun. Mind, this is Palestine, working out in the sun, this kind of labor. This would be around May, June, end of April, that period of time. So they would have a little break here. What she really testifies to is she's a hard worker. Now, this wouldn't be pleasant work. This is hard work. And the servant even admires that. She came and has remained from the morning and only took a little rest. She is a hard worker, a diligent worker. And again, you appreciate the character of Ruth. Not a pleasant life, not an easy life. Now her task is not easy, but she's pursuing it with diligence, and her testimony is making an impact and will have far-reaching consequences. Appreciate that about her. Here she is doing what she has to do and doing it evidently without complaint. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter." Many believe that this address, calling her my daughter, would indicate that Boaz is probably significantly older than Ruth, and there's some other indications we'll see as we move further through the book that may be so. Later on, Boaz will say to her that appreciates the fact she didn't chase after some of the young men, which may indicate that he's a little older. Of course, there's advantage to older men. We all realize that. I realize it more today than I did 20 years ago. I keep reminding Marilyn of the advantage of an older husband, too. It's just great. Okay, verse 8, that has nothing to do with this story. Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen carefully, my daughter. Do not go glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go from this one. Stay here with my maids." Now, Boaz is a man who appreciates her commitment and he wants to make her life a little bit easier. But he just doesn't say, go home with Naomi and I'll send you whatever you need to eat. He probably could have done that from the description of him earlier. And they said, why didn't God do that? He's a relative. Why didn't he just say, I'll send the food to your house. Don't worry about that. That's not the way God works. But God is going to take some of the edge off of the burden that Ruth has been bearing. Because now Boaz says, stay in my field. Evidently, it was a practice that, you know, they'd glean, but they may go from field to field looking for better gleanings. Didn't look like they were getting enough from this field. They might decide to try look at another field. Boaz says, don't go anywhere else. Verse 9, let your eyes be on the field which they reap. Go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. Now keep in mind, we're in the time of the judges. And you remember how the book of Judges closed with the way that the concubine was treated. This was not a day where the men of Israel were functioning, generally speaking, with godly character. Now, a woman like Ruth, who's evidently an attractive young woman, has to be out in the field all day long with the servants. And there always is the danger and the possibility that they will begin to get out of line and mistreat her, both verbally and physically. And there's going to be a repeated emphasis we'll see here. But I want you to pick it up now. You realize that Ruth's situation was not an easy one, not a pleasant one. Go out gleaning in the field was not only hard work, it put you in a kind of setting that subjected you to abuse, verbal and physical abuse. And a young woman like Ruth was not safe in Israel in these days, in these kind of conditions. But Boaz has intervened. I've commanded the servants not to touch you. And furthermore, when you're thirsty, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants draw. Of course, water, certain servants were responsible to bring enough water for them. Because working out in the heat and in the sun, they needed the water to keep on going. But those gleaning, the poor gleaning in the fields, had to take care of their own water supply. And that became a difficulty. Now, Boaz is making it much easier for Ruth. You can come and drink the water that's provided for my servants. Verse 10. The response of Ruth here is very significant. Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me since I am a stranger? Ruth does not have the attitude that she is owed anything. Again, you realize and appreciate her commitment back in chapter 1. That no strings attached commitment. Here she doesn't come here thinking that these Israelites owe me something. It's just the opposite. Why would you treat me with such kindness? I am a foreigner, and you know that. And you're even less obligated to me than you might be if I was an Israelite woman. And she manifests that godly humility. That why would you treat me with such kindness? There's not that bitterness seething on the inside of Ruth as she's going through her activity, thinking if they were really godly people, they'd take a little more interest in helping us out. All of that may have all been true, but it's irrelevant to her. She evidently come to understand Naomi's thinking that our God has brought adversity and we live with it. Boaz tells her, I've heard what you've done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband. I've heard how you've left your father and your mother, the land of your birth, and came to a people that you did not previously know. Boaz understands what a tremendous commitment that was. He appreciates the faith and the faithfulness of Ruth. That this was a costly decision to leave her homeland of Moab, to leave her father and her mother, and to join herself to the widow Naomi, herself being a widow, and come here without any future. So Boaz quite up front says, I've heard that. I've appreciated that. Verse 12, may the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. Boaz prays to God that he will reward Ruth for her faithfulness. May the Lord reward your work, and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel. And you see here something of the godly character of Boaz. And he believes that God will undertake for Ruth. Little did he know that he would be the answer to this prayer in the plan of God. Very beautifully put, the end of verse 12, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. Boaz sees the commitment that he talked about in verse 11 with the abandoning of father and mother and home. He sees that commitment as a decision to seek refuge under the care of the God of Israel. And he is sure that God will honor that commitment. You have made a decision. When you made the decision of verse 11, that was a decision to seek refuge under the wings of God. And that picture that is used numerous times in the Old Testament of God's people finding shelter and protection under the care of God, as the young chicks do under the wings of the mother. Look just in the Psalms with me, over in Psalm 17. Very warm and caring picture that is painted here. And again, you know, it might be easy for Ruth to run through her mind and say, well, that's easy for you to say, Boaz. But you can see how a godly character provides the opportunity for special blessings. In Psalm 17, verse 8, keep me as the apple of your eye, apple of the eye. Hide me in the shadow of your wings. Again, that's where my protection, that is where my care, that's my refuge. Hide me in the shadow of your wings. Psalm 36, verse 7. How precious is your loving kindness, O God, and the children of men take refuge in the shadow of your wings. Same picture. Chapter 57, verse 1. Be gracious to me, O God, be gracious to me, for my soul takes refuge in Thee, and in the shadow of Your wings I will take refuge until destruction passes by. See, under His care, that's where I'm safe. Till the destruction passes by. Psalm 61, verse 4. Let me dwell in Your tent forever. Let me take refuge in the shelter of Your wings. Chapter 63. Verse 7, for You have been my help, and in the shadow of Your wings I sing for joy. Chapter 91, verse 4, He will cover you with His pinions, and under His wings you may seek refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and a bulwark. You see the protection and security that is there. And we're all familiar with Matthew 23:37, where Jesus says to the people of Israel, the children of Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered you as a hen does her chicks, and you would not. What a tragedy. That refuge, that protection, that care was offered to Israel. They rejected. But Ruth had made that commitment to seek refuge under the provision and care of God. Good reminder for us as God's children. When we're under pressure, when we're under difficulty, it's enough to be sheltered and protected by God. That doesn't mean He removes the pain, He removes the storm. It means He preserves us through it. He assures that He is caring for us. Back in Ruth chapter 2, she says in verse 13, I have found favor in your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and indeed have spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants. Again, she doesn't regard the favor of Boaz as something she deserves. Rather, she demonstrates that true humility and appreciation for his kindness. Let me say something here. Godly humility does not expect others to act graciously on our behalf. We do not deserve blessing and favor from God or others. When I begin living expecting others to treat me in certain ways, it's an indication I'm really not living a life of godly humility. And if we're honest, we all fall into that pattern. That people ought to treat us a certain way. That they ought to give attention to us. And when they don't, it becomes a cause of bitterness. Not so with Naomi. Here is kindness shown. She says, well, I really deserve this after everything I've been through. No. I'm amazed that you would be so kind. That you would show such favor. You can see how she could go through the difficulties. With that kind of attitude, if you're not expecting anything, you're not disappointed. I've shared with you what Marilyn shared with the ladies. Perverse as it was. She said, I never expect anything from Gil, and I'm never disappointed. Well, that's done marvels for our marriage. You know, and that's the way we as believers ought to be. And that means anything that God graciously provides and does, even through others, is something we weren't expecting. If I come to church and I don't expect everybody to pay attention to me, I don't expect anybody to pay attention to me. And I don't expect anybody to be looking out for me. I just come to be used of God and other people's lives and offer Him my worship. Then if someone does say hi to me, someone does go out of their way to me, I'm amazed because I wasn't expecting it. But if I come expecting it and someone doesn't, all of a sudden I'm bitter. I'm not going back to that place. They're cold. They don't care. They're not loving. And it's not true of godly character being manifest. So you appreciate the godly character of Ruth, even as a young believer. Verse 14. At the mealtime, so Boaz is hung around, he invites her to come and share in the meal with him and his reapers. Now again, what he's doing here is marking Ruth off as a special person. And another reminder to the servants and the reapers that this is a special woman. And she's not treated as a second-class citizen here. Stay out of our way. Don't be a bother. And that was a requirement for the gleaners. You come after we're done harvesting. You don't get in our way. And don't expect anything special. But here Ruth is marked off. She can come and eat with us. And Boaz even serves her, if you will, and gives her extra portion so she has some left over for Naomi to take home with her. So he has honored her here, and that will help in the relationship with the servants. Verse 15, she's given permission to glean. He commanded his servants, let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not insult her. She doesn't have to wait till the reapers are done. She has the freedom to glean in the field. And don't insult her. So again, that reminder, you get the idea, these servants who are reaping the field could be difficult characters to work with. Also, you shall purposely, verse 16, pull out for her some grain from the bundles. Leave it that she may glean and do not rebuke her. So even goes beyond. When you're gathering it all up into the bundles, you be sure you drop some out of those bundles. Leave them there in her path. So you look back and see her coming along, you got that bundle, you just sprinkle some of those out. So she's sure that she's got armfuls of grain. Do not rebuke her. Again, you see, it's been repeated through this chapter. I say that because you appreciate back in verse 2, when Ruth took the initiative and asked Naomi to give her permission to go to the field. That was not an easy thing to do. It was not a pleasant task. It's just not the hard work that it's associated with it. But it's the abuse that might come along with the hard work. But God has graciously provided and protected her. What Boaz has said is true. He's using Boaz to carry out what Boaz has referred to in verse 12. She gleaned the field until evening. Now, the work's not over. She's been treated kindly, but she's still got to be out there working. Then she had to beat out what she gleaned. Thresh it out. And then bundle up what she had in the grain, and she had about an ephah of barley. There's some discussion of how much, probably about a half a bushel, or about 30 pounds. Now, this is an unusual large gleaning, you might expect. And Naomi's going to be amazed when she gets home. So she has prospered through this whole event. Verses 18 and 19, she returns home. She gives Naomi what was left over from the meal. Remember? Verse 14, Boaz had given her plenty for herself, and she had some left over. Well, she gave what she had left over after she had been full from the meal she had out in the field. That's what's referred to in verse 18. It's not the idea she came home and ate as much of the grain she could eat, then gave some to Naomi. That's the leftover from lunch, so to speak. And then Naomi says to her, "Where'd you glean today? Where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed." I mean, Naomi's aware this is not an average gleaning, what you've brought home. So she told her mother-in-law, whom she had worked with, and the name of the man was Boaz. Now, keep in mind, Ruth, Boaz is just a nice guy. She hadn't read verse 1. But Naomi had read verse 1 because she knew who Boaz was. Boaz! Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed of the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead." And again, Naomi said to her, "The man is our relative. He is one of our closest relatives." I mean, you start to catch the idea that Naomi's getting excited here. I mean, she's planning a marriage is what she's doing. Some things never change. Then Ruth the Moabitess said, "Furthermore, he said to me, 'You should stay close to my servants until they've finished all my harvest.'" So Ruth begins to give her more of the story. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maids, lest others fall upon you in another field." See the danger? So it goes beyond just verbal abuse to even the danger of physical abuse that Naomi was concerned about. You'll be safe in his field. You may not be safe in another field. So she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. So Boaz had encouraged her to stay. The wheat harvest followed the barley harvest. And she stays in Boaz's field and lived with her mother-in-law. Now, you note here, God has made provision for them. He's provided food. He's provided protection for Ruth. But he has not immediately resolved their problem. Ruth still has to go up and go out and glean in the field. Still living with her mother-in-law. No assurance that the future will hold anything for them, but that they'll have ample food now. Remind you what Paul said, if we have food and clothing, we'll be content. And you get that idea that here are two women that can be content because of what God provided. You know, through this all, it is the sovereign hand of God at work. I was reading a commentary this afternoon. I want to share a little bit out of it with you. I think it was clear as we read this story, the focus is on God and the provision that God makes. There's a commentary written by an evangelical. He's graduated from a couple of our better seminaries, and he teaches at an evangelical graduate school. We talk about Ruth and her adversities. I want you just to take note here of how easily we can get off the track as believers. This is entitled An Expositional Commentary, A Story of God's Grace. But I think it's a corruption of God's grace. He asked the question, "But what, may we ask, is required of a person if he or she is to surmount the adversities that invariably come one's way?" How do you handle adversity in your life? He's taking this out of the discussion of Ruth in chapter 2. Modern research has identified 5 characteristics that are of fundamental importance to each of us if we are to triumph over the vicissitudes of our human existence and lead happy, effective, fulfilled lives. Somewhere along the line, we've left the Scripture, and some of his exposition of Scripture is very good. But now, if you're going to handle the adversities of life and the changes in life, life's variableness, Well, modern research has identified five characteristics that have to be true of you if you were to have a triumph over these changes in life and lead a happy, effective, fulfilled existence. These are, number one, a sense of personal autonomy. Two, our sexuality, how we think of ourselves as men or women. Some of you like that. It is the best one. Our internalized sense of morality, our career choice, our hope for the future. Now, where did we leave Ruth? I mean, these are the things that have to be true of Ruth. Now, what has happened? Ruth is obviously a person who triumphed in adversity. Modern research has said these five characteristics have to be true of a person who triumphs in adversity. So you see where he's going? These five things had to be true of Ruth. So the next number of pages are trying to show you how these were all true of Ruth. Well, I won't read you those five pages. I want you to have something to be thankful for. But I will read you a couple of things. Jumping over. She may have been beaten down by the sheer weight of her trials. This is Ruth. But she still had confidence in herself and in the one under whose wing she had taken refuge. Chapter 2, verse 12b. Now all of a sudden we've got a combination here. She may have been beaten down by the sheer weight of her trials, but she still had confidence in herself. Did you come across that in our study of chapter 2? She had confidence in herself and in the one under whose wing she had taken refuge. Under whose wings you've come to seek refuge. That's blasphemy. That's saying that Ruth's triumph over adversity wasn't due to God alone. It was due to the fact she had confidence in herself and in the God under whose wing she had taken refuge. God couldn't have done it unless Ruth had confidence in herself. I mean, modern research has shown us the triumph in adversity. You have to have confidence in yourself. All of a sudden, the Scripture is not adequate and not sufficient. We have to try to read men's ideas into the Scripture. Ruth was evidently sufficiently secure in herself and confident enough in the Lord not to allow her anxieties to goad her into unwarranted activity. Ruth was evidently sufficiently secure in herself and confident enough in the Lord. Where do you get this sufficiently secure in herself? We begin to read into Scripture. Who gives man the right to corrupt the Word of God? Here's a man who graduated from Dallas Seminary, Talbot Seminary, and teaches at the Graduate School of Campus Crusade in a book published by Moody Press, who takes liberties with the Word of God like that. And Ruth is an example. We need not use our work as an outlet for our neurosis. I was happy to learn that. Here, unless you think I'm being too harsh, how we overcome the vicissitudes, he really likes his word vicissitudes. At my age, I'm hard time to say it. How we overcome the vicissitudes, that's the variableness, changes of life. Maybe you already knew that. I had to look it up. How we overcome the vicissitudes, I've read this three times because I have to practice the word now. I'm going to read it the fourth because I still haven't finished the sentence. How we overcome the vicissitudes of life depends on two things. This is the climax of this chapter. How we overcome the changes of life, the variableness of life, depends on two things. Number one, the way we think of ourselves. Number two, our confidence in the Lord. You know, every time he's talked about this, the number one thing is how you see yourself. The way we think of ourselves. And secondly, our confidence in the Lord. In other words, confidence in the Lord won't get you through the troubles of this life. You have to first think of yourself properly and then have confidence in the Lord. Ruth illustrates for us the personal dynamics that will help us rise from the ashes of our experience and persevere. That's rubbish. later on, are often in our desire to help others, we try to do everything for them. We make them feel dependent on us. When this happens, we erode their sense of esteem. What they need is a genuine feeling of, I believe in you. I approve of you. Did you get that all out of chapter 2? You know, somewhere along the line, this expositional commentary left exposition. And we've wedded it all together, and by the time it all gets done, we now have man's ideas and God's ideas. And what God does is good, and when you put that together with man's proper view of himself, you can really handle life's troubles. Well, I thought I'd share that with you. It's a reminder that we come to the Word, we ought to limit ourselves to the Word. I believe that I am able to handle whatever comes in life because I've taken refuge under the wings of the Almighty. I don't have anything to do with my sexuality. I don't have anything to do with my view of myself. And it gets all in here into your work and everything else. All of a sudden, what's it mean to be under the wings? You say, well, these chicks under the wing, if they've got a proper view of themselves, if they've got a healthy view of their sexuality, then they'll be safe. All of a sudden, the chicks are 50-50 with the mother hen. That's blasphemy. That's an attack on the character of God and His sufficiency. You don't find that in Ruth. Well, there are six lessons I've drawn from this chapter. Number one, there are no accidents with God. Verse 3, she happened to come to the portion of the field. But you have to put that in the context of verse 1. Humanly speaking, she just happened into the field of Boaz. But the whole purpose of this writer, even in putting verse 1 first, was so you appreciate the providence of God. It's His hand that's guiding and directing her. We're living our lives submissive to Him. We go ahead and pursue. Ruth knew she had to get out into the field and glean. She didn't have to spend 10 days praying about, should I get out there? Where should I go? What field should I get to? She simply got about doing, and God was controlling and directing her life. Number 2, our break with the world testifies to the reality of our faith. Our break with the world testifies to the reality of our faith. We saw that in chapter 1, but it's emphasized in verse 11 again as Boaz relates the impact of what Ruth has done upon him. He's heard. And so he prays for God's blessing on her in verse 12. Number 3, God is a refuge for those who trust Him. The end of verse 12, under whose wings you've come to seek refuge. God is a refuge for those who trust Him. Number 4, God often provides comfort and encouragement through others. God often provides comfort and encouragement through others. Verse 13, you have comforted me, spoken kindly to your maidservant. But number five, godly humility does not expect others to show them favor. Verse 13. Also mentioned in verse 10. Verse 10 and verse 13. Godly humility does not expect others to show them favor and kindness. And if you're expecting that from others, you need to back up and examine your godly humility. And number 6, the physical protection of the believer is provided by God. That has to do with being under His wings. But then verse 9, verse 12, verse 15, verse 16, verse 22, all reminder of how God provided for the protection of Ruth. So she took refuge under His wings. And she is secure there. And God provides for the physical protection of this woman in these times. Chapter 1, we saw the hand of God bringing trials and difficulties into the lives of His children. Chapter 2, We see the hand of God bringing comfort, encouragement, protection, and blessing to His children. The same God, the same children. One constant in both chapters. God is sovereign in all things. He's graciously working His perfect plan in the lives of His children. That adversity was part of His plan. And now the blessing that has begun in chapter 2, which will grow, is part of His plan. We can rest secure in the care of God that whatever we are experiencing is part of His plan for us.